Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us today. We're also pleased to welcome back the two folks that I like to call our resident literary prospectors because every once in a while here on the show, we ask them to come in and talk about what they have been reading lately. The two people I'm talking about, Philip Graham and Tanya Liatsakos. Philip teaches here at the U of I in English. He teaches writing and is a writer himself. Tanya works at Pages for All Ages Bookstore. And among other things, they're really voracious readers. They love books and spend a lot of time prowling through the aisles at bookstores and looking for new things. And then when they're here, they always bring several and tell us about what they have been reading. Sometimes read excerpts, and it's a lot of fun when they're here. And I know that I have gotten some good recommendations from them while they've been here, and I expect other people who are listening have done the same. So it'll be the usual kind of exercise. It's been a little while since they have been here, and this, I guess we'll just call this our summer reading show. There still is some summer left. So we'll have the opportunity to get some of their recommendations. And as always, is always the case for people who are listening, maybe there is a book that you have read recently that you thought was particularly good and you'd like to talk about and to recommend. So all you have to do to be a part of the program here is to give us a call. The number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So in any case, so whether you're here in Champaign-Urbana, use that first one, the 333-WILL. And then if it would happen to be a long-distance call for you, you can use the toll-free line, and we will pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Well, see those red buttons there that say on? Push those buttons on your guide. There you go.
We're on.
You're on now. Thanks. Excellent. Very much for being here. We're glad to have you here again. Is it really true that last time you were here, it was when we were doing Fun Drive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did we let it go so long?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know.
I don't know.
I've personally been sitting by the phone waiting, tears rolling down my cheeks.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're pleased to have you here.
Thanks.
So, what have you been reading lately?
Lots of good stuff.
Lots of good stuff.
Yeah. Well, you want
I always forget who went first last time.
You always let me go first. You should.
I do? I think Tanya pretty much always, I think we
okay.
do.
Okay, I always go first.
So. Okay.
Gentleman first.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks very much.
Now, if we could find a gentleman.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'll pretend to be one. I'd like to read from a book of poetry, and maybe I'm starting with this because I know that Tanya was talking before the show about how she's actually, unusually for her, she says, recommending a book of poetry.
Very unusually, yeah.
So I'm going to start with someone. This is a poet named Theodore Deppe. His last name is spelled D-E-P-P-E, and it's from his new and selected poems called Cape Clear. I saw him give a reading of his work in Vermont last month, and it was a pretty extraordinary reading. And Theodore Deppe actually knows our own Bridget Kelly. They went to high school together,
oh.
I discovered. And he has taught a lot in Ireland, now also in America. He was a nurse at an hospital for abused children for many years. And this is one poem that I'd like to read from that. It's called Admission, Children's Unit. Like the story of St. Lawrence that repelled me when I heard it in high school, how he taught his disciples to recognize the smell of sin, then sent them in pairs through the Roman Empire, separating good from evil, brother from brother. Scrap of legend I'd forgotten, until interviewing a woman, I drew my breath in and smelled her, catching a scent that was there, then not there. She said her son set fire to his room. She'd found him fanning it with a comic, and what should she have done? Her red hair was pulled back in a braid. She tugged at its flames. And what she'd done, it turns out, was hold her son so her boyfriend could burn him with cigarettes. The details didn't, of course, come out at first, but I sensed them. The boy's refusal to take off his shirt. His letting me, finally, lift it to his shoulders and examine the six wounds, raised, ashy, second or third degree, arranged in a cross. Silence in the room. And then the mother blaming the boyfriend, blaming the boy himself. I kept talking to her in a calm voice, straining for something I thought I smelled beneath her cheap perfume, a scent. How can I describe this? As if something not physical had begun to rot. I'd like to say all this happened when I first started to work as a nurse, before I'd learned not to judge the parents. But this was last week. The mother was crying. I thought of handing her a box of tissues, and didn't. When the Romans crucified Lawrence, he asked Jesus to forgive him for judging others. He wept on the cross because he smelled his own sin. Sullen and wordless, the boy got up, brought his mother the scented blue Kleenex from my desk, pressed his head into her side. Bunching the bottom of her sweatshirt in both hands, he anchored himself to her, glared at me. It took four of us to pry him from his mother's arms.
Oh, my God.
There are so many powerful poems in this book. I could read this whole book.
Are they all experience? Do they all reflect experience he's had in the...
Everything. In fact, the trouble I've had today is whether I should read one more, one about his daughter leaving home to explore the world, or another one based on Anton Chekhov's experiences in Sakhalin Island off the coast of Siberia. And I could go on. These are just great, great poems.
Yeah.
Which one do you want to hear?
Let's hear the Chekhov.
Okay. This is called Letter to Savorin, a friend of Chekhov's, and it's in the voice of Anton Chekhov. He traveled from Moscow to, St. Petersburg, to an island off the coast of Siberia, 6,000 miles, to investigate a penal colony. 11th of July, 1890. Greeting, friend, from the world's end. This is called Letter to Savorin. Greeting, friend, from the world's end. You were right, the tea is terrible. We are moored at last off Sakhalin. Because there's no true harbor, we'll sleep on board, across the Bay of Reefs by daylight. 6,000 miles of floods, thieves, mud, and tedium between me and home. I almost understand why you say this place doesn't concern us. On shore, forest fires march down the mountains. Perhaps these flames are eternal. No one in the village tries to put them out. On deck, the same numbed peace. Women and children, soldiers and manacled convicts huddle together and try to sleep. But even here the weeks pass. It's August now. I woke at 5 this morning, as I do each day, to bells from St. Vladimir's squat log cabin of a church. Since the convicts are refused entrance, I too stay clear. I pulled on 2 pairs of trousers for warmth, smoked my pipe watching the Tartar Straits sunrise, then worked till dark. I've decided to interview every person on the island. You say these lifers hold no interest, but on the contrary, I can't stop thinking of them. This morning I met Mikhail, a man chained 2 years to a wheelbarrow, like so many others, but with his 4-year-old, his Nadja, who's always at his side, even sleeps in his barrow. And thin Anna, a 12-year-old who answered all my questions, then asked, could I afford a whole ruble to lie with her? I forced myself last week to watch a whipping. A doctor, like myself, examined the man they meant to break, pronounced him fit for 90 lashes. The flogger dealt 5 blows from the left, 5 from the right, impassive as a teacher belting a child. It's not the same, I know, but I kept seeing my father, how he'd lift the cane above his head, reaching for more force. I was 5. He made me kiss the rod that taught me justice. I fled the guardhouse, the whipman's cries following me down wooden sidewalks. In 1 yard I saw a rooster tied by its leg, in another a lock and chain around a pig's neck. I swear everything on this island's bolted down. I climbed to the lighthouse, my favorite spot, spray breaking over rocks named the 3 murderers, and along the cliff line the wind-blown fires have their own grandeur. What do you think? Is even hell beautiful? Alexei, how I long to leave this island. When I see you next in Petersburg, we'll have tea and jam on a silver tray. How absurdly happy I felt just now writing that. Imagine, candlelight on thick preserves, raspberry or gooseberry, and everything terrible in life
again, going on out of sight. Listen, friend, I need you. Tell me, how do we savor good tea while others suffer? How do we give thanks for the taste of gooseberries?
Oh my God.
That's really beautiful.
That's fabulous, yeah.
And the whole book's like that. It's an unbelievable book.
Theodore, what is it?
Theodore Deppe, D-E-P-P-E, and it's called Cape Clear, New and Selected Poems.
And I think for what we have done when you've been here in the past, we've tried to make sure that we get all of the information about the writers and the books onto our website so people won't have to. Maybe the people will be taking notes anyway, so but if they have internet access, they can go to the website and do that. Let me ask you a question. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't, because I don't want to get off into a big discussion of poetry. But I think that if you had sat down and said, I'd like to read you a couple of really short stories, we would have gone with that.
And at the end,
we wouldn't have said, hey, wait a minute.
That was poetry.
That's right. That's right.
What makes those poems?
What makes those poems?
Yeah, I mean, why are
they? Well, these are very narrative-based, as you might have noticed. I mean, these are poems that tell stories. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if there is a hallmark of Deppe's work, as I've noticed reading this, is that he likes to tell stories. But he also concentrates things in such an extraordinary way. I mean, when you think about that moment at the admission desk is not a short story, though it is a narrative. Okay, it's mm-hmm. really just... If it were in a story, it would be an anecdote. It would be a scene. It wouldn't be the whole thing.
Right.
But the poem concentrates it so that when you bring in St. Lawrence, when you bring in that sense of, you know, St. Lawrence was a saint who was crucified, you know, for his faith, and yet who the narrator thinks of rather critically because of the way he expressed his faith and the fact that Lawrence himself recanted not his faith, but the way he expressed it when he was being crucified. And here is the narrator who... Judge Lawrence is judging this woman, and now is judging himself for that judgment. It's powerful.
Yeah,
I think each word is much more concentrated.
Yeah.
Each word, it must be just the right word for a poem. Not that that's not true of you know, prose, but yeah.
Well, you know, we see those fires that no one's putting out. You know, and the first time we see them. Their fires being put out. But the next time we see them, when Chekhov is looking at them through the poet's eyes, they're the fires of hell. You know, and so he takes the physical world and he changes it as the repetition comes in and so forth. They're very artful ways that this is done. And, of course, the rhythm of reading it.
The rhythm,
And looking at the line breaks, it's beautiful to see how you're hearing sentences on the radio.
Mm-hmm, but the line breaks,
The line breaks actually add meaning that you really have to see in order to really...
Yeah, it's very visual.
You know, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
Harriet Williamson obviously was listening at her desk when she heard me talk about the list being on the website, and she came in and she says, in fact, they're already on the website.
Okay, great.
So at will.uiuc.edu, if you go to our program, you'll find the lists that we're talking about. And Philip Graham, Tanya Latsakos, the guests here this morning, they're here occasionally on the show, and they talk about... new books, not always necessarily new, but books that they would recommend.
Yeah.
And you can do the same, too. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Now, it's Tony's
turn. We're on poetry, I think this is the first time I've ever recommended a poetry book. I'm not really a poetry reader. I appreciate it. I don't generally genuinely enjoy it.
Shame on you.
Shame on me. I know. But, you know, I'm just being honest. This, however, is incredible. I have a poet friend who's really into him. His name's Tony Hoagland, H-O-A-G-L-A-N-D. And I believe he was here in the spring.
He was here in February.
February.
I really felt bad. I had to miss his reading because I was in New York on a research trip. I really felt terrible about it.
I didn't go either, and now I really wish I had. Mm. And she had showed me. This is his third book of poetry. He teaches at Houston, I think, with Mark Doty, who's another good writer. Mm-hmm. He is – it's hard for me to say why I like these so much. They're very honest. Mm-hmm. They're very accessible. And he's very narrative, too, actually. Well, some of them are. Here. Mm. Okay. We'll start with this one. I have two. Okay. This one's called Social Life. After the first party peters out, like the gradual slowdown of a merry-go-round, another party begins, and the survivors of the first party climb onto the second one and start it up again. Behind me now, my friend Richard is getting a fresh drink. Anne, in her black dress, is fanning her breasts. Cynthia is prancing from group to group, making kissy face. It is not given to me to understand the social pleasures of my species, but I think what they get from these affairs is what bees get from flowers, a nudging of the stamen, a sprinkle of pollen about the head and shoulders, whereas I prefer the feeling of going away, stretching out my distance from the voices and the lights until the tether breaks and I am in the wild, sweet dark, where the sea breeze sizzles in the hedge top and the big weed heads, whose names I have never learned, lift and nod upon their stalks. What I like about the trees is how they do not talk about the failure of their parents. And what I like about the grasses is that they are not grasses in recovery. And what I like about the flowers is that they are not flowers in need of empowerment or validation. They sway upon their thorny stems as if whatever was about to happen next tonight was sure to be completely interesting. The moon rising like an ivory tusk, a few sextillion molecules of skunk strolling through the air to mingle with the aura of a honeysuckle bush. And when they bump together in my nose, I want to raise my head and sing, "I am a child in paradise again, when you touch me like that, baby." But instead, I stand still and listen to the breeze streaming through the upper story of a tree and the hum of insects in the field, letting everything else have a word, and then another word, because silence is always good manners and often a clever thing to say when you are at a party.
Very nice.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
It does make me think about one of the things that about poetry, and I don't know, you know, how often this occurs to people. Maybe it does when they just read something like that. It's good. You think, well, you know, I've experienced sensations like that.
Absolutely.
I've had moments like that. But somehow you don't really – what this does is that it brings it into a very sharp focus.
Yeah.
And in ways that when we're going through our daily experience, we just, so much of the time, we're just plodding along.
Absolutely.
We're putting one foot in front of another, and we're just not paying attention.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's really human experience,
focused. The window into the poet is also the window into the reader.
Yeah. Ooh.
Okay, let me write that one down. Is that you? Did you make that up?
That's me.
All right. Very good. Would you like to read another?
I would love to read another. This one is very narrative. It's called The Change. The season turned like the page of a glossy fashion magazine. In the park, the daffodils came up, and in the parking lot, the new car models were on parade. Sometimes I think that nothing really changes. The young girls show the latest crop of tummies, and the new president proves that he's a dummy. But remember the tennis match we watched that year, right before our eyes? Some tough little European blonde pitted against that big black girl from Alabama, cornrowed hair and Zulu bangles on her arms, some outrageous name like Vandella Aphrodite. We were just walking past the lounge and got sucked in by the screen above the bar, and pretty soon we started to care about who won, putting ourselves into each whacked return as the volleys went back and forth and back like some contest between the old world and the new. And you loved her complicated hair and her to hell with everybody's stare. And I couldn't help wanting the white girl to come out on top, because she was one of my kind, my tribe, with her pale eyes and thin lips. And because the black girl was so big and so black, so unintimidated, hitting the ball like she was driving the Emancipation Proclamation down Abraham Lincoln's throat, like she wasn't asking anyone's permission. There are moments when history passes you so close you can smell its breath. You can reach your hand out and touch it on its flank. And I don't watch all that much Masterpiece Theater, but I could feel the end of an era there, in front of those bleachers full of people in their Sunday tennis-watching clothes, as that black girl wore down her opponent, then kicked her ass good, then thumped her once more for good measure, and stood up on the red clay court, holding her racket over her head like a guitar. and the little pink judge had to climb up on a box to put the ribbon on her neck, still managing to smile into the camera flash, even though everything was changing. And in fact, everything had already changed. Poof, remember? It was the 20th century, almost gone. We were there, and when we went to put it back where it belonged, it was past us, and we were changed.
Tony Hoagland is the poet. What's the
collection
title of the book?
Is What Narcissism Means to Me.
I love that title.
Yes.
Okay. Well, here we're almost already at the midpoint of this part of Focus. And I know we just got started with Philip Graham. He's professor of English at University of Illinois. Tony Latsakis works at Pages for All Ages Bookstore. And we just have some suggestions for you for summer reading. When they're here, they always bring in books, sometimes new, not necessarily, but things that they've been reading lately that they think are really good. And they would just like to suggest that you might take a look at. You can do that too, by the way, if there's somebody who's listening and wants to suggest a book. You may certainly call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So, what do you got, Philip?
Before I read this, I just want to do a testimonial here to my fellow guest. I read recently Normal by Amy Bloom, which you recommended.
She's wonderful.
And a nonfiction book.
All her short stories are good also.
And it's a wonderful book. So I just wanted to second that wonderful recommendation of yours.
Thank you.
Okay, this is the first novel by a writer who I greatly admire. Finally got a copy of this. It's Chronicle in Stone, a novel by Ismail Kadare, an Albanian novelist who is nominated every year for the Nobel Prize. I think after I read the opening to this novel, you might understand why. This is set during the time just before and then really near the end of World War II. It's the lives of a number of villagers living in a village, all the houses made of stone on a hill, and a very isolated village. And so it's almost as if you're looking at the events of World War II through the eyes of a medieval mind in terms of how isolated the people are from the 20th century. And the narrator is a young boy who is naive on top of that because he's got a lot of imagination and he sees things differently from the adults. And this starts out where he's describing the rain, water, and the cistern at the bottom of his house. Outside, the winter night had wrapped the city in water, fog, and wind. Buried under my blankets, I listened to the muffled, monotonous sound of rain falling on the roof of our house. I pictured the countless drops rolling down the sloping roof, hurtling to earth, to turn to mist what would rise again in the high white sky. Little did they know that a clever trap, a tin gutter, awaited them on the eaves. Just as they were about to make the leap from roof to ground, they suddenly found themselves caught in the narrow pipe with thousands of companions asking, "Where are we going? Where are they taking us?" Then, before they could recover from that mad race, they plummeted into a deep, dark underground prison, the great cistern of our house. Here ended the raindrops' life of joy and freedom. In the dark and hollow cistern, they would recall with dreary sorrow the great spaces of sky they would never see again, the strange cities below them and the lightning-ripped horizons. Sometimes, playing with a mirror, I would send them a slice of sky no bigger than the palm of my hand, which would flicker on the surface of the water, a fleeting memory of the endless sky. The raindrops spent tedious days and months below, until my mother, bucket in hand, would draw them out, disoriented and dazed from the darkness, to wash our clothes, the stairs, the floor. But for the moment they knew nothing of their fate. They ran, happy and noisy, across the flat slate of the roof, and I felt sorry for them as I listened. When it rained 3 or 4 days in a row, my father would push the gutter pipe aside to keep the cistern from overflowing. It was a very large cistern extending under most of our house, and if it ever overflowed, it would flood the cellar and wreck the foundation, and anything might happen then, because our city was so steep. As I lay wondering whether man or water suffered more in captivity, I heard footsteps and then the voice of my grandmother in the next room. "Hurry, get up. You forgot to disconnect the gutter." And what follows is a lot of adult business in which they're terrified that the cistern is going to overflow and ruin the foundation of the house because this it's been raining so much. And so while this is going on, you know, the parents going from house to house on the street, getting people to bring buckets to drain some water out of the cistern, this narrator, this young man, goes down to the cistern to check out what's happening. I went to the opening and looked down. Gloom, gloom and a sense of fear. Ow! I said softly, but the cistern didn't answer. It was the first time it had refused to answer me. I liked the cistern a lot and often leaned over its rim and had long talks with it. It had always been ready to answer me in its deep, cavernous voice. Ow, I said again, but still it was silent. I thought it must have been very angry. I thought about how the countless raindrops were gathering their rage down below. The old ones that had been languishing there so long getting together with the newcomers, the drops unleashed by tonight's storm, plotting something evil. Too bad Papa had forgotten to move the pipe. The waters of the storm never should have been let into our well-behaved cistern to stir up rebellion.
Wow, that raindrop business is fantastic.
And his imagination is like that throughout the book.
Yeah,
wow. Though it changes as he gets older and the events of the world alter him and the lives of his family. Yeah. It's a wonderful book.
I read two of his books on based on your recommendation. Mm-hmm. Was that during that time that mm-hmm. you were, it was like the only thing you wanted to talk about.
Do I do that?
No. And I thought the one was the book about building the pyramid.
Yes.
And the other was about the man who worked in the Ministry of Dreams.
Yes, right.
And
right.
I thought they were both very, very interesting. I would anybody go to the bookstore, to the library, see whatever you can find by this man.
Chronicle in Stone was the name of this one. And also Broken April about blood feuds in Albania is perhaps his most powerful book. But this also is a fabulous book. Yeah.
Is that something that's not going to be easy to find?
You know, I hate to say this. I had to order it over the web. It is in print, but it's a small press, New Amsterdam Books. But it's... you know, New Amsterdam Books, have you heard of it? No. Will he win the Nobel Prize someday? Yes. But unfortunately, that's the way publishing is these
right.
days.
Right. You know?
Okay. An increasingly larger and larger amount of the books that I love are not published by what we consider mainline publishers.
Well,
they just don't do it anymore.
It won't make them enough money, I guess.
Yes, right. That's garbage sales. Yeah.
Oh, well. Well, back to Tanya can take another turn.
Okay. I'd like to recommend a novel called Motherless Brooklyn by Jonathan Lethem. He wrote Fortress of Solitude, which won something, didn't it? Did you read that?
No, I didn't.
I didn't either.
But it might have won something.
Yes, it did.
That's his most recent book, which probably... Is that in paper yet, Fortress of Solitude?
I believe it is in paper, yes. Okay. It is now in paperback. Yeah, it won last year. I don't know what it was. Mm-hmm. I wish I could remember it. He's going to look it up for me here. This is a novel about... Well, this is really not the typical novel that I read. It's very detective story, which generally really turns me off.
Really?
But I found his writing to be so interesting that that I thought I'd give it a shot. And then I realized that the main character has Tourette syndrome, which is a fascinating disorder. And I've read a couple of books previously about it. So then I was hooked, and I thought, well, you know, I'll just get past the detective story. But now I'm completely enthralled and, you know, can't wait to write. Yeah. So, yeah, it's fabulous. So his story is Lionel is his name, Lionel Esrog. And he grew up in an orphanage in Brooklyn. He has no idea who his parents are. He was dropped there when he was an infant. And it's an all-boys Catholic orphanage. And he has had a real struggle with Tourette syndrome, but had no name for it. And it's not chronological, the book. It's not linear. So we jump around from when he was 12 years old to when he's a full-grown adult. There's a man named Frank Minna who is really fishy. He's clearly part of the mafia, some type of mafia organization, and he comes to the orphanage and wants a number of boys to help him, to be his assistants. And all these boys are just dying to get out of the orphanage. They're about 12, 13 at the time. And so they go with him, and of course he doesn't divulge to them that anything they're doing is illegal. nor does he divulge it to the reader, but it's very obvious. And they just want an excuse to get out. Now, the thing about the Frank Minna character is that he's really a good guy. Even though he's involved in some illegal activities, mm-hmm. He has a good heart. He really loves Lionel. He calls him Freak Show. But he accepts him and he loves him with all of his tics and problems because he doesn't try to hide it. And Lionel actually spends his entire young adult and part of his adult life working for Frank Minna, doing detective work, or so he thinks. Mm-hmm. As an adult, he starts to understand that that's not exactly what's going on, but it's kind of the only father figure he's ever known. And his Tourette's is really bad, and for people who don't know about Tourette's, his is not, he's got everything. It's not just verbal. It's not just physical. He's got all of the symptoms of Tourette syndrome. Oh. Very, very difficult to deal with. Verbal is his worst tick. He counts things. He touches things. He's into symmetry. He if someone says to him, if his boss Frank says to him, you know, you've got to get your gun, get the phone, get in the car, and get going. Got it? Mm. All he hears is get, got. Mm. And he can't stop that. Now, this is actually very helpful to Frank Minna's organization, because what he does is he puts Lionel with a wire and he tells him to listen for verbal cues, where the normal person might get very bored and miss these verbal cues. Mm. Lionel is very tuned in. Mm. Looking for this specific phrase or specific word. So he's very accurate with mm-hmm. things. Yeah. And that helps Frank in his business. The passage I'm going to read is just a little taste of what goes on in Lionel's brain mm. just on a regular, cool. on a daily basis. When he was in this orphanage, he went through a period where he couldn't stop kissing people. He just was compelled to kiss his fellow boy, you know, students mm-hmm. On the face, on the head, on the hand, wherever he could get. And, of course, you know, he was really, really ridiculed for this. And the only way he could think to explain it is that it's a game. It's a game. He didn't really have the words or the knowledge to explain to them what was wrong with him, nor would they care anyway. They're 12-year-old boys. They're just crucifying him for this. But he finally got over that, and he did the kissing as a way to keep himself from expressing verbal tics, which he felt like was the most embarrassing thing. But he's getting past that now. Meantime, beneath that frozen shell, a sea of language was reaching full boil. It became harder and harder not to notice that when a television pitchman said, to last the rest of a lifetime, my brain went, to rest the lust of a loaf tome. And when I heard Alfred Hitchcock, I silently replied, Altered House Clock, or Ilford Hotchkiss. That was when I sat reading Booth Tarkington in the library now, my throat and jaw worked behind my clenched lips, desperately fitting the syllables of the prose to the rhythms of Rapper's Delight, which was then playing every 15 or 20 minutes out on the yard, that an invisible companion named Billy or Bailey was begging for insults, I found it harder and harder to withhold. The kissing cycle was mercifully brief. I found other outlets, other obsessions. The pale 13-year-old that Mr. Cassell pulled out of the library and offered to Minna was prone to floor tapping, whistling, tongue clicking, winking, rapid head turns, and wall stroking, anything but the direct utterances for which my particular Tourette's brain most yearned. Language bubbled inside me now, the frozen sea melting, but it felt too dangerous to let out. Speech was intention, and I couldn't let anyone else or myself know how intentional my craziness felt. Pratfall's antics, those were accidental lunacy, and more or less forgivable. Practically speaking, it was one thing to stroke LaShawn Montrose's arm, or even to kiss him, another entirely to walk up and call him Chiffon Mongoose, or Left-Hand Moon Prose. So though I collected words, treasured them like a drooling sadistic captor, bending them, melting them down, filing off their edges, stacking them into teetering piles. Before release, I translated them into physical performance, manic choreography. And I was lying low, I thought. For every tick issued, I squelched dozens, or so it felt. My body was an overwound watch spring, effortlessly driving one set of hands double time, while feeling it could as easily animate an entire mansion of stopped clocks, or a vast factory mechanism, a production line like the one in Modern Times, which we were watching that year in the basement of the Brooklyn Public Library on 4th Avenue, a version accompanied by a pedantic voiceover lecturing us on Chaplin's genius. I took Chaplin and Buster Keaton, who's the general, had been similarly mutilated, as models, obviously blazing with aggression, disruptive energies barely contained. They'd managed to keep their trap shut, and so had endlessly skirted danger and been regarded as cute. I needn't exactly strain to find a motto. Silence, golden. Get it? Got it. Hone your timing instead. Burnish those physical routines, your idiot wall stroking, face making, lace chasing, until they're funny in a flickering black and white way, until your enemies don policemen's or Confederate caps and begin tripping over themselves, until doe-eyed women swoon. So I kept my tongue wound in my teeth, ignored the pulsing in my cheek, the throbbing in my gullet, persistently swallowed language back like vomit. It burned as hotly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, that's good.
Yeah.
Ooh. That's Jonathan Lethem, and the book is Motherless Brooklyn. Was that the first novel that he had published?
Yep, that's the first
published?
One. Yep.
Okay. Well, we'll go on. Philip, it'll take another turn.
Okay. Just a little pause a moment. That was pretty powerful.
That was
wow.
good.
Okay, this is a very, very interesting memoir, probably the most unusual memoir that I've ever read. It's called A Postcard Memoir by the writer Lawrence Sutton. And it's, in fact, a postcard memoir. It's all you in Radio Land can see because I'm holding the book up to the microphone. Every other page is a photograph of a postcard, usually antique. Well, most of these are antique postcards from the turn of the century or the early decades of the 20th century or the latter decades of the 19th century. And there's a very interesting prologue as to why the author has decided to write a memoir based on the postcards that he collected in his life. What first caused me to confuse postcards and life was an accidental glance while getting change for a purchase at the Star Bookshop in Cambridge, Massachusetts back in 1973. There was a shoebox by the cash register full of old postcards priced a dime apiece. At the front was the postcard of the mosque at Sidi Okba, pictured later in this book. My glance grew into a stare, and then there was a brief mind pop in which I entered the mosque and felt its cool air and the sand-gridded flagstones on my bare naked feet. I bought that postcard and started to buy more, whatever caught my eye. There was almost a decade during which I stopped because I thought it was getting ridiculous, the clamminess of a collection, and I boxed my postcards up and kept them in the basement. But then they started to appear in my dreams as lost times, lost knowledge, lost children. So I let them out and started to accumulate them again. Some years ago, I learned by accident that postcards offered a way to shatter the mirror of the everyday and to enter into whatever I was writing. I would look through a goodly sized pile, and by the time I was done, my brain had chased its tail and I was ready to say what I needed. It came about that certain memories of mine began to seep into certain postcards, there to remain like bugs in amber. Other postcards challenged me to come out after them and fight like a writer, which I did, realizing, accidentally again, that they were egging me on through the stations of my life. And so what I love about this is, you know, one of the unspoken stories about this memoir is a man who collects postcards, perhaps unconsciously because they remind him of things about his own life. They're not just pretty pictures. And then when he starts to write his memoir, he needs to look at the postcards, which are not about his life on the exterior level, because on the interior level, they remind him very much of his life, and they bring back memories that in many ways he might not have been able to recall with such intensity if these postcards weren't there before him. And I want to they're very short. There's all, the basic structure of this is on one page is a postcard and the other page is a short prose piece. This section is called Man and Boy. And it's a picture of a very well-dressed, two suited individuals, a young boy standing by his seated father. It's clearly a formal picture taken, I would say, somewhere in maybe the 1910s or 20s. And it's very sort of, you know, a placid formal portrait. And here's what Larry Sutton has written about it. Fathers more easily love their daughters. Sons are the continuation of us in an obvious sense. So obvious that it is unbearable. In the case of my father and myself, I had the fullness of his face and his desire to write, which had been abandoned when he came to America with a family to raise. What he wanted to see in me were the practical choices he had made confirmed. At times in my youth, he justly found me clumsy, cowardly, callous, and he let it be known. His anger had then the finality of a curse. The great task in the life of a son, is to realize that his father is right and then proceed to be wrong. It's your only chance to become someone you haven't already met. My father also let his love be known. Once he cried because he feared I did not love him back, lay down on his bed fully dressed in the middle of the day and cried. My mother found me and pulled me by my scruff to the doorway of their bedroom to see. She was hating me. So I lay down beside him and hugged him. That was hard. He was a middle-aged man who was sobbing and sweaty, and his body was heavy and so soft, I imagined his ribs giving way like a snowman's on the first warm winter day. I could hear his heart, and it sounded as if it were working harder than it could take. I hugged him until he stopped crying. I whispered in his ear that I loved him. And here's a different one, very different. This is called Le Conteur des Histoires, which is the storyteller, and it's a picture taken, again, maybe in the late 19th century, looks like in North Africa, of an old Muslim man surrounded by a circle of other Muslim men, and he's clearly declaiming, telling stories. And this is, again, because this is a chronological memoir written by a writer who is looking at this and, I guess, thinking of age coming to him well, because this is, among other things, about age. So he's looking at this postcard and he says, "This is what TV looked like before we got it. A bunch of people sitting in a circle, watching and listening to the same thing. In those days, old people could be that thing if they could tell stories. Old people are pretty much not allowed on TV unless they are interviewed about money or dying, the subjects on which they have retained an aura of special expertise. Back then, an old fart who remembered what had happened once was interesting because you figured it might happen again. Nowadays, only reruns happen again in genetic engineering and computers and TV. There was a pattern in stories that people believe emerged through remembering. The pattern bloomed in your brain like a bush you'd forgotten was growing and now spouted roses. On TV, there's mostly fantasies, not patterns. And the fantasies have to act fast or we click to a new one. The old storyteller carried a staff and coins were thrown into a calabash there by his bare feet. It was like food being made for you. You didn't just take your story. You paid. TV is all the food you can eat every day for just about free. That's the fantasy you watch with."
Wow, I love that. That's awesome.
This is a really terrific book, and one of the most original memoirs I've ever read.
And it is a memoir.
Yes, it's an absolute memoir. It goes all throughout his life. A postcard memoir by Lawrence Sutton. Great book press.
Well, we have maybe 7-8 minutes left in this part of the show, and we'll just sit here and listen.
Yeah.
I hope everybody's having a good time at home. I am.
Yeah, me too.
Okay. This book is crazy. It's called Stiff: The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. It's had a lot of press lately. It's by Mary Roach, who's a journalist. And it's a nonfiction book. She's done a bunch of research and gone to a whole bunch of different medical schools and institutions to interview people and document stuff. And it's everything you would ever want to know about dead people, from how much the human head weighs, to what happens to us, how do we decompose if we're not embalmed, surgeons, how do they learn to do what they do, what's the hands-on experience, history, there's a lot of history in it, anatomists, what they did 200 years ago, what they do now, how that's changed. It's fascinating. And the weirdest thing about it is that she's really clever and funny. And it's this dark, morbid subject and will make you sick to your stomach at times. It's more than you ever really wanted to know. But she treats it with like it's a thing. It's a real thing. And so let's just talk about it. And in life, there is humor. And so in this, there is humor. Mm-hmm. And she is just she's a really good writer. And the passage I'm going to read is she's gone to a university to where a group of surgeons, experienced surgeons, are learning some new procedures. Mm-hmm. And they're using human heads to learn these new procedures. This is how these things work. You know, what do we know?
Cremation those of us, for me. Sorry.
Yeah, same here. Cremation same here, Philip. Me. Cremation yeah. for me. Yeah. There's a whole bunch in here about that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
it's...
Well, okay.
Yeah, I don't know if...
maybe I'll get frozen.
Something. Oh, my gosh. Okay. She's interviewing a surgeon about how she deals with this. She's in a room with a... there's a big, long table, and at each... And there's little workstations, and at each station... There is a human head, right, in a roasting pan. This is how these things are done, you know. So she's interviewing one of the surgeons about how she...
Lunch is how far away?
Deals with this. Yes, exactly. Okay, so she asks her, and the surgeon says, "What I do is I think of them as wax." Teresa is practicing a time-honored coping method, objectification. For those who must deal with human corpses regularly, it is easier, and I suppose more accurate, to think of them as objects, not people. For most physicians, objectification is mastered their first year of medical school, in the gross anatomy lab, or gross lab, as it is casually and somewhat aptly known. To help depersonalize the human form that students will be expected to sink knives into and eviscerate, anatomy lab personnel often swathe the cadavers in gauze, and encourage students to unwrap as they go, part by part. The problem with cadavers is that they look so much like people. It's the reason most of us prefer a pork chop to a slice of whole suckling pig. It's the reason why we say pork and beef instead of pig and cow. Dissection and surgical instruction, like meat eating, require a carefully maintained set of illusions and denial. Physicians and anatomy students must learn to think of cadavers as wholly unrelated to the people they once were. Dissection, writes historian Ruth Richardson in Death, Dissection, and the Destitute, requires in its practitioners the effective suspension or suppression of many normal physical and emotional responses to the willful mutilation of the body of another human being. Heads, or more to the point, faces, are especially unsettling. At the University of California, San Francisco, in whose medical school anatomy lab I would soon spend an afternoon, the head and hands are often left wrapped until their dissection comes up on the syllabus. So it's not so intense, one student would later tell me, because that's what you see of a person. The surgeons are beginning to gather in the hallway outside the lab, filling out paperwork and chatting volubly. Let's see. Blah, blah, blah. She asked some people some questions. And, okay, so they're going to start the seminar. This is intense. The seminar begins with a review of facial anatomy. "Elevate the skin in a subcutaneous plane from lateral to medial," intones the narrator. Obligingly, the surgeons sink scalpels into faces. The flesh gives no resistance and yields no blood. "Isolate the brow as a skin island," the narrator speaks slowly in a flat tone. I'm sure the idea is to sound neither excited and delighted at the prospect of isolating skin islands, nor overly dismayed. The net effect is that he sounds chemically sedated, which seems to me like a good idea. I walk up and down the rows. The heads look like rubber Halloween masks. They also look like human heads, but my brain has no precedent for human heads on tables or in roasting pans or anywhere other than on top of human bodies. And so I think it is chosen to interpret the sight in a more comforting manner. Here we are at the rubber mask factory. Look at the nice men and women working on the masks. I used to have a Halloween mask of an old toothless man whose lips fell in upon his gums. There are several of him here. There is a hunchback of Notre Dame, bat-nosed and with lower teeth exposed, and a Ross Perot. The surgeons don't seem queasy or repulsed, though Teresa told me later that one of them had to leave the room. They hate it, she says. It means working with heads. I sense from them only a mild discomfort with their task. As I stop at their tables to watch, they turn to me with a vaguely irritated, embarrassed look. You've seen that look if you make a habit of entering bathrooms without knocking. The look says, please go away. Yeah. So she goes to all of these places and interviews all these people and does all of this research and talks about all of the ways. I mean, there's a chapter about crash test dummies. Yes. And wow, it really makes you feel like we are just bodies when we go, you know. Yeah. It's really interesting. A lot of history, a lot of humor. A lot of heads.
On that end, we'll have to. On that end, we'll have to end. Whoa. You never know what these kids are going to come up with. If you'd like the information on these books, and there are a couple that we did not get to.
Sure.
They're on the website.
We'll get a little sooner than last time, right?
I promise. A little sooner than last time. WILL.UIUC.EDU. Philip Graham and Tanya Leotsakos. Thank you very much
for having me.
Thank you.
A lot of fun.